In this series that we wrap up next weekend, God is, we've been looking at different attributes, characteristics of God every weekend. So like, you know, God is holy and God is peace and God is generous. And in today's installment, we're just going to talk about the topic, God is creative. God is creative. And the specific aspect of the creativity of God that I want to dial in on today is God's creativity in our pain. How God can take, can be at work through and in and around our upheaval and discomfort and our deep disappointment and our grief in order to do something remarkably good that we simply can't see and quite frankly never can imagine. The creativity of God in our pain and in our upheaval. And I just want to begin this conversation by talking about something I've talked about in the past. The single greatest season of upheaval in my life, which events revolving around my mom's death. Now, if we've been hanging out together for years, you've heard me mention this or talk about this in different ways a number of times over the years. And I was reminded last weekend that we always have visitors and new people that are making Ada Bible Church their home that I totally don't know the backstory that I come with. And so let me mention this again, though, for those of you that have been around for a long time. We've talked about this a number of times. Now, I awakened one November morning of my seventh grade year to learn that my mom had been killed in an automobile accident the night before. At the time, my mom and dad had five children. My sister was 13. I was 12. My younger brothers were 9, 4, and 2 months old. And the two-month-old baby, James, lived through the accident that killed my mom. To say that that was a day our lives changed, it'd just be a radical understatement. At the time, my mom and dad had started a church in a town southeast Idaho, Blackfoot, Idaho. Blackfoot, Idaho. The main industry was potato farming, just filled with potato fields around. And there were other things that flavored our community. There was like our street on the edge of town, then the Blackfoot River, and right on the other side of the Blackfoot River was the Fort Hall Indian Reservation, which brought some flavor to our area. And so of the different terms I could use to describe Blackfoot, Idaho, when I was spending my grade school years there, Of the descriptors, I would never choose the term socially sophisticated. This was not a socially sophisticated area. And months after my mom's death, my dad moved us from Blackfoot, Idaho, not simply to the Midwest and not simply to Grand Rapids. My friends, we moved to East Grand Rapids from Blackfoot, Idaho. And those of you away from Grand Rapids that are watching this, East Grand Rapids has a reputation of being one of the more affluent areas in our city. I don't think I would have had a bigger culture shock if I had moved to Zimbabwe. And so I was awkward. Now, trust me on this. As an eighth grader, I could have been awkward anywhere. It's just that East Grand Rapids kind of put a microscope on my awkwardness and amplified my awkwardness. I'm telling you, some years back, I was in Barnes & Noble in Woodland Mall, and I'm standing there looking at a row of books, and over a little bit, there's a guy, and he looks over, and then he does a double take, which usually means, you're my pastor, and we've never met, right? But that wasn't what this double take was. A guy does a double take and says, you're Jeff. I go, yeah. He says, we went to middle school together. And immediately I went, no. He said, I remember you. You were countercultural. I said, let me help you out here. The term you're looking for is socially illiterate. And he said, no, I remember you. You didn't have to be like everybody else. And I'm going, I tried. That little moment in Barnes & Noble just kind of highlighted that not fitting in. So we moved to Grand Rapids. Months after we arrived, my father remarried a younger, much younger woman, 14 months after my mom's death. And then after eighth grade and freshman year at East Grand Rapids, my dad announced that we were moving to Sacramento, California. So I talk about being upended. Upheaval. My whole grade school, this farming town where you kind of know your place. You feel like you have a place. One funeral, one wedding, and two cross-country moves later, everything had flipped upside down and flipped upside down again. And I think that the question, how in the world can God possibly be at work in such times? I think that's a fair question. And it's an opportunity for us to talk about the creativity of God. How God works creatively, not just in spite of our pain, but God works creatively in and around and through our pain to bring about good that we could never imagine and cannot see when we're caught in the moment. God is creative with our pain and our... He is not restricted to using only good ingredients in bringing about a good end and a good result. He can use all levels of nasty and horrible and grief and pain and loss to bring about a good end. So let's talk about it. Let's talk about the creativity of God in our pain. And we're going to turn to one of my very favorite stories in the Bible. It's one of the earliest stories in the Bible. And we're going to unfold the story in four parts. And part number one is the funeral. Part number one, the funeral. Dad is dead and has been buried. And the brothers, there had been an incredible amount of upheaval in the family and hurt caused in the family, but there had been forgiveness and peace while Dad was alive. And the question on the brothers' minds is this: was that peace temporary? Was that forgiveness just kind of temporary ceasefire? And now that Dad's gone, is all hell going to break loose? Is it going to turn into all-out war now that Dad is no longer here? Because they had caused an incredible amount of damage in the life of one of their siblings who now had a lot of power. And if he wanted to put the hurt on them, he could do it. The dad who has passed away, his name is Jacob. And the son that had received so much damage at the hands of his brothers, his name is Joseph. And the question the brothers have when Jacob, the dad, dies is this. Genesis chapter 50, verse 15. When Joseph's brothers saw that their father was dead, he said, man, what if Joseph holds a grudge against us and pays us back for all the wrongs we did to him? They know the damage that they caused. With the loss of their dad, is Joseph now going to pay him back for all the damage that they caused? That's the question that drives the story after the funeral. And we need to know something. This, the pain started even before Joseph was born. So part one of the story is a funeral. Part two of the story is a family drama. Family drama. Jacob has 12 sons from four different women. And you thought your family was messed up. And this is the way it happened. Jacob lives in a place called Canaan, and he lied to his dad, and he ripped off his brother, and he fled for his life. Jacob travels up north, meets a distant relative by the name of Laban, and goes to work for Laban. Laban has a daughter named Rachel that Jacob just finds just adorable, falls in deep love, or at least deep infatuation with this woman, Rachel. And he tells Laban, her dad, I'll work for you for like 7 years in order to get her hand in marriage. And literally works for Laban for 7 years. And then finally he says, you know, I want the bride you've promised me, Rachel. And those of you who know the story knows what happened here. Apparently there's a veil in the wedding ceremony. Apparently the bride is veiled. And I suspect that there might have been more than just a little bit of wine. They go into the room following the wedding ceremony, and Jacob wakes up the next morning and looks next to him, and it's not Rachel that he's worked for 7 years. It's her sister, Leah, that he didn't care for. Yes, this is really in your Bible. The wife he didn't want, the woman he's not attracted to at all. And then he comes out storming out, like, what have you done? And the dad says, oh, it's not our custom here to marry off the younger daughter before we marry off the older daughter. Work for me for another 7 years, and you can have Rachel too. So I think it's 14 years of labor. And now he's married to sisters. How many of you think this is going to go well? It's going to be a mess. It is going to be a mess. And what complicates the situation even more is that Rachel, the woman he loves, goes through infertility. And Leah, the woman that he got tricked into marrying that he doesn't love at all, she starts having kids. The names that she gives to her sons, highly instructive in understanding the emotional landscape of the story. Son number one is Reuben. She names him Reuben because the Lord has seen my affliction. Surely my husband will love me now. Now that I've delivered a son, maybe my husband will love me now. Son number two, Simeon. Because the Lord has heard that I am unloved, therefore he has given me this son also. Son number three, Levi. Now this time my husband will become attached to me because I have borne him three sons. Pain is dripping from the page. Son number four, Judah. This time I will praise the Lord. Is she like giving up on ever winning this guy's heart? It's this weird triangle where Leah, she wants Jacob's affection. Jacob, he wants Rachel's affection. And Rachel just wants to beat her sister. It's a mess. It's just a mess. It gets even more convoluted and complicated when Rachel, in her infertility, wants a son, but she can't deliver a child. And so she says, here, take my slave, take my servant. I think her name is Bilhah. Sleep with her and give me a child through her, like a surrogate mom for Rachel. Bilhah has two. And Leah looks over and says, well, two can play at this game. She gives Jacob her servant, I think her name is Zilpah, and Zilpah has two kids, so now we're like up to eight, and then Leah has two more. Leah six, Bilhah two, Zilpah two, total of 10, Rachel zero. And then, Rachel, the wife that he loved, the woman he adored, the woman that he had worked for so long, she gets pregnant and she delivers a son. The son's name is Joseph. I'm telling you, the first time that Jacob scoops up Joseph, I just imagine him saying, a son, a son, a son, I finally have a son. And there are 10 boys going, and what are we? And what are we? Rachel will have one more child, Benjamin, Joseph's full brother. And she will die in childbirth. As all this is going on, she names Reuben, Simeon, Levi, Judah. Finally now my husband will become attracted to me. Finally now my husband will love me. Finally now. Do you think the boys figured out what was going on? Do you think it was a secret which mom was loved and which mom wasn't loved? I think Joseph entered the world being despised because of the deep attraction that his father had to him that he didn't have for the others. And that's before the kid just turned 17, and Jacob gets him the Technicolor coat. We called it, when I was growing up in Sunday school, the coat of many colors. It was a richly ornamented robe. Something about this robe that Jacob gets his 17-year-old son, Joseph, it's not the kind of robe you would go out and herd goats in. It's not the kind of robe that you would harvest grain in. This coat looked kind of managerial. So you're not making son number 11 son number 1, are you? Oh, yeah. 10 brothers go off. Two sons of Rachel are at home. 10 brothers go off with the family's herds. Jacob sends Joseph out to check up on them, find out how they're doing, find out what they're doing, and come back and report. They see him at a distance, and it's like, hey, guys, here comes the coat. Here comes the coat. They hate him, and they decide when he gets here, we're going to kill him. One of the brothers, I think it's Reuben, said, no, let's not kill him. Let's just throw him into a pit. He plans on coming back later and rescuing Joseph and getting him back safely to his dad. While Reuben is away, a caravan passes heading to Egypt, and they sell Joseph as a slave. And Joseph's heading down to Egypt now. Now, what do you tell dad? They take the richly ornamented coat. They kill a goat. They put blood on the coat, and they bring it home, and they go, Dad, this isn't Joseph's coat, is it? And Jacob sees the coat covered in blood and goes, surely a wild beast has torn him apart, and Jacob is inconsolable. My son is dead. And now, wherever the family travels, they travel with this deep, dark secret as to what has been done. What you're expecting now is for the camera to kind of focus in on the Jacob family and what they do following the sale of son number 11, Joseph. But what happens is the camera follows Joseph down to Egypt, where we have part 3 of the story, which is the waiting room. And my friends, of the agonies in life, getting stuck in the waiting room. Permanent delay is one of the toughest. Joseph is sold into the family. A guy by the name of Potiphar buys Joseph. Apparently he has a pretty sizable estate, pretty important person. And while Joseph is working for this guy Potiphar in his estate, we read these stunning words from Genesis chapter 39. It says, the Lord was with Joseph so that he prospered, and he lived in the house of his Egyptian master. Can you indulge me? Can we read those first 5 words together? Ready? The Lord was with Joseph. I'm thinking, no, he's not. If the Lord were with Joseph, he'd be back home, the favored son of a wealthy nomad. So, no. In this captivity, the Lord was with Joseph. Already there's this kind of this undercurrent of the presence of God in the middle of Joseph's suffering, Joseph's betrayal, and Joseph's pain. And this guy Potiphar, he starts giving Joseph more and more responsibility. It's like everything Joseph touches turns to gold and prospers. And so it's like, man, let's give him more responsibility, put him over more things, see those areas grow as well. Joseph is young. Joseph is talented. Joseph is gifted. Joseph is hardworking. Joseph is attractive. And Joseph gets the attention of Mrs. Potiphar. His owner's wife starts hitting on him. And Joseph is like, yeah, look, this isn't going to happen. My master, Potiphar, he has put me in charge of everything here. There is only one thing that's off limits, and that's you. How could I sin against my boss in doing this? And one day, he shows up in the house, and she's like evicted all of the other servants. She's the only one in there. And she like grabs his coat, and she's like, okay, now. And literally, he gets out of his coat and runs outside. To my count, this is the second time he's lost a jacket in this story. And she hangs on to it, and she's angry. And Potiphar gets home, and she says, your servant tried to rape me. And Potiphar is furious. Throws Joseph in prison. And it's hard, and it's long. By my math, the time Joseph spends working in Potiphar's estate and the time he spends in prison is 13 years. 13 years in the waiting room. You'll never believe what five words occur about Joseph when he's in prison. Any guesses as to what those five words might be? Check it out. The warden paid no attention to anything under Joseph's care because the Lord was with Joseph and gave him success in whatever he did. The warden starts turning the prison over to Joseph. The Lord was with Joseph. And again, I want to go, no, he's not. If the Lord were with Joseph, he'd be out of prison and in a better situation. No, the Lord was with Joseph in prison. My friends, this is so powerful. It's powerful on two levels. It's powerful level number one, because it's just a reminder here that God was present in Joseph's detour. The waiting room. God was present in Joseph's detour, and the Lord was with Joseph. The other powerful thing here, and don't lose sight of this, is that Joseph was present during his detour. I mean, Joseph could have shown up in Potiphar's house and said, I didn't sign up for this. I was kidnapped. I was put here. You can't get me to do anything. You just try to get me to lift a finger. Not only is God present in Joseph's detour, Joseph is present in Joseph's detour. And I just want to say, when you're in awful and ugly space that you don't want to be in, bringing yourself to everyday responsibility, it's hard. Joseph was present in his detour, because the easiest thing to do when we're in space we abhor and detest and loathe, the easiest thing to do is to zone out and to numb out and to check out. Just, this doesn't count, I shouldn't be here, and we just shut down. Please notice that Joseph doesn't shut down. What if the space that we loathe and hate is producing a crop that we desperately need? There's a episode of a recent series that has caught my attention. The series is called The Bear. Just a warning label on this here. Incredibly volumes of coarse language, layers of family dysfunction, and long, profane, screaming matches. I guess what I'm saying is, in referencing this, I'm not recommending this for your 13-year-old, and I might not be recommending it for you. I mean, it's pretty rough. But there's this redemptive moment that happens that I think is so powerful. And the context for the show is Chicago, and there's a family restaurant. It's a sandwich place, Chicago original beef. And Carmine, the new owner, he decides to transform it not simply into a Chicago beef sandwich place, but into a high-end restaurant. And as they're renovating the space into a high-end restaurant, he has to take his employees and get them to do something else because the restaurant shuts down when they're in the renovation. Now, the guy in the picture there, Richie, he goes to another restaurant in order to serve as a stodge in that restaurant, an unpaid intern. And so the scene that you have when he's working as a stage in this other high-end restaurant is he reaches over, the alarm clock is going off, and it's like 5:38 a.m., 5:38. He's out of bed, he drives to the high-end restaurant, and that day he is given a job of polishing silverware. For a couple of minutes? No. All day long, polishing silverware. Next day, alarm clock rings. It's 5:35, reaches over, turns off the alarm clock, goes in all day, polishing silverware. Day three, reaches over, turns off the alarm clock. It's 5:34. They keep going back to the alarm clock because it's like Groundhog Day. Every day is becoming like every other day. And he goes in, and now he has an altercation with a manager, a back-of-the-house manager, where he says, let me do something else. I'll help wash dishes. And the guy looks at him and says, no, we have the best dishwashers in the world. You would only slow things down. Another day of polishing silverware. And he is so angry at his cousin for condemning him to this humiliating post. And it's like, you put me here to humiliate me. And it's like, no, I've got you there to refine you. It's like day 4 or 5, he comes to polish silverware, and he puts on a suit, and they expose him to the front of the house and the way things are organized and how meals are expedited, and he really falls in love with the hospitality culture of this restaurant. Now, fast forward the tape. It's opening day for the Chicago Beef Place, transformed into a high-end restaurant. Carmine, the owner and chef, gets locked accidentally in a walk-in cooler, and the handle is not working from his side. He spends the entire evening on opening day inside the walk-in cooler, and everybody's kind of like flipping out. And then Richie, the guy with the unpaid internship, steps up, steps in, and begins to calmly control traffic. Something he never would have been able to do without being stuck in that polishing silverware day after day and then exposure to the hospitality culture. It's like, you've got me, you hate me. You've got me here to humiliate me. No, I have you there to refine you. Again, what I'm saying is sometimes the very space we hate is the space that God is using to do something in our hearts, to do something in our lives that otherwise would not take place. I mean, check this out later. James chapter 1 in our Bible, where right out of the gate, the author James says, consider it pure joy when you encounter trials of many kinds. Joy? Trial? Yeah, I don't think so. He says, why? Because this testing of your faith produces a patience, and let patience do its work on you, and you will end up being complete and whole, lacking nothing. You don't give, we don't have joy. We don't choose joy in trial because the trial is joyful. We choose joy in trial because we believe in the creativity of God to be doing something in us and around us through that awful space that we do not like at all. 13 years, Joseph is now elevated out of prison and given some major responsibilities in Egypt by none less than Pharaoh. Joseph gets married. Joseph begins to have kids. The names he gives to his sons, highly instructive. Manasseh, son number one, God has made me forget all my trouble and all my father's household. The pain is draining away. God has caused me to forget all my trouble and all the challenges with my family. This isn't something Joseph said on day one. This is with some time and with some perspective. God has caused me to forget. And then he has another son named Manasseh. And Manasseh, God has made me fruitful in the land of my suffering. God has made me fruitful in the land of my suffering. Understand something. He calls it what it is, suffering. He doesn't minimize it. He doesn't sugarcoat it. It's the ability to look at something awful and ugly and call it awful and ugly. But he said, God has made me fruitful in the very place of my suffering. Already you see again undercurrents of the presence and the creative goodness of God in working in and around and through Joseph's pain and upheaval and being upended. Joseph is put in charge of grain distribution in Egypt. There were like 7 bumper crop years where just everything grew. And it's a supply and demand. You can buy low, basic economics, and then there's like 7 years of famine where nothing's growing, and then you sell high, and Joseph is making an incredible amount of money for Pharaoh, and people are coming from the famine-stricken area from around Egypt, standing in line to buy grain, and there's the day that Joseph looks out, and they're in line to buy grain are 10 guys he recognizes. He recognizes them. They don't recognize him. And my friends, we have the makings of one of the best revenge stories ever to be written. Now you're going to get yours. Part 4 of the story, the reunion. Why don't they recognize Joseph? He's wearing Egyptian clothes. He's probably got Egyptian makeup. Furthermore, he doesn't talk to them. He talks to them through a translator. through a translator. He doesn't even let on that he knows their language. He says, what are you here for? We're here to buy grain. No, you're not. You're spies. You're spies. No, we're not. We're brothers. We're 12 brothers. Well, this is 10 of us. One is back home with dad, and one is no more. And Joseph has to leave the room to cry. And he comes back in and says, you prove to me that you're not spies, that you're actually 12 brothers. Go back home and get the youngest one. You know what the kid's name is? Benjamin, his full brother, the other son of Rachel. Bring him back, and then I will know that you're really 11 brothers. They go, our dad is never going to let us take him. His brother showed up missing once, and he's never going to let the other son of Rachel. Well, you're not going to see my face again until you bring the kid. The kid. He's married with children, and he's still called the boy. I wonder what it was like to be Benjamin. Wonderful. I'm going to go swimming. Put on a life jacket first. Dad, I'm 17. Get off that roof. Send one of Leah's sons up there on the roof. You could fall, you know. Benjamin, he's back home with dad. Finally, they run out of food, and they talk dad into letting them bring Benjamin, and now he sees the tent, and he sees his brother, his full brother. He frames him. He frames him of stealing. And then says, now, I caught him. Now, you 10, you go back home. I'm going to keep him in prison here. Why is he messing with them like this? He's not messing with them. He's asking a question. And the question is this. Would you do it again? Would you go back to dad a second time and tell him that he's lost his other son from Rachel? Would you break our dad's heart again? And in this long speech, a brother by the name of Judah steps forward and says, now please, 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 please keep me in prison here, but send the boy home. It will break my dad's heart. My dad won't survive this if they go home without Benjamin. Keep me. And this is where Joseph says, I am Joseph. Is my father alive? It is the only time in history we have 10 collective heart attacks. The family moves south during the famine. Come under Joseph's care and under Joseph's provision. I think the reunion happens when Joseph is 39 years old. 22 years after they sold him as a slave, and dad dies. And they go, he's going to get us now. There was a ceasefire when dad was alive, but now that dad's gone, the wrath of his vengeance is going to fall on us. And they come to make an appearance in front of Joseph. And the question is, what is Joseph going to do in this moment? And Joseph's statement provides for us what I believe to be one of the best verses in the Bible on the creativity of God. Genesis chapter 50, verse 20, Joseph says to his brothers, you intended to harm me, but God intended it for good to accomplish what is now being done, the saving of many lives. What you did 22 years ago, you intended to harm me. God intended it for good. It's like without me being here in this position to bring you under my protection and my provision during this famine, how many of our kids would have died in the famine? How many of our grandchildren would have starved to death? Our family would have been decimated during this time. We would have been wrecked as an extended family. It's like God sent me ahead of you through your evil to bring about this good, the saving of many lives, the creativity of God. But we have to come to grips with something here, that God is not restricted to using only good ingredients to bring about a good end. What is it that provided for the rescue of the family? What ingredients went into that pot? A dad who wasn't particularly wise in showing his favoritism? A messed up marriage? Being hated and despised by his brothers, being sold as a slave, being falsely accused by his boss's wife, all of these things get thrown in, and out of that comes the rescue of a family. And what I'm trying to say here is that there are often times where you don't see the goodness of God in the moment, but you're attempting to maintain a bedrock trust in the eventual and ultimate goodness of God. Joseph is thrown into a pit and is being sold as a slave. Ask him, are you feeling the goodness of God right now? Uh-uh, not seeing it. Falsely accused by Potiphar's wife, thrown into prison. Are you experiencing the goodness of God right now? No, not feeling it. At the end, 22 years later, he's 39, he says, I see the goodness of God profoundly over time, distance, and perspective, how God was at work in and around and through the pain. It is a bedrock trust in God's ultimate and eventual goodness, even when we're not seeing it and don't understand it and can't imagine how God might use something good, do something good ultimately. So there's a common imagery that is used. I didn't come up with this, but I just kind of love it. It has to do with the two lenses. And the first lens is the zoom lens that focuses in. So just kind of imagine a tree, and this represents your current trauma, your current upheaval, your current grief, your current loss, your current medical situation, your current family disruption, and it's all you can see in the zoom lens. It dominates your vision. And then there's the other lens, which is the wide angle lens, and it zooms out, and there's more than just the suffering, upheaval, and pain that we're experiencing right now. I just have to say something, though. Only God gets the wide angle lens fully. In the moment, it's something we can't see and possibly can't imagine. The wide-angle lens is what Joseph experienced when he said, okay, the tree, you meant it to harm me. The wide-angle lens, God meant it for good. Sometimes we get to see it in our lifetime. The expression for this theologically is this expression right here. It's called future grace. It's what allows you to have joy in a season of hardship, trial, and grief. Future grace. It's a trust that someday God will show his goodness through this misery. Revelation chapter 21, the next to the last page of your Bible, where it says, the voice coming from the throne of God, I am making everything new. There will be no more crying. There will be no more death. There will be no more pain. This whole old order of things will be pushed aside. It is the day that God will undo pain. It's future grace. And often that is faith stabilizing and trust stabilizing and just allows us to keep our heart and head and faith together when we feel upheaval. In knowing that within the creativity of God, there is the ability for him to do remarkably good out of a remarkable mess, which takes us to the story of the trampoline. Our old house in the country, I'm jumping on the trampoline with my probably 5-year-old son. Chris and I have 3 children, a daughter and 2 sons. My youngest son, Alex, is in the backyard jumping on the trampoline with Alex. Probably about 30 years ago, he's mid-30s now, and he's like kindergarten age at the time. For jumping on the trampoline, he asked a great question. His question was, how did you meet mom? How did you meet mom? And I said, oh, but I met your mom in California in youth group. I was 17, and I went to youth group one night, and your mom was visiting there, and I needed a missionary project. So I met your mom when I was in California. And he asked a follow-up question. He said, was that before or after your mom died? I said, but that was after my mom died. When my mom died, I was living in Idaho, and my mom died when I lived in Idaho, which is where I went to grade school. And he said, how did you get from Idaho to California? And I said, well, after my mom died, my dad moved us to Michigan, which is where Grandpa Mannion, your grandpa, that's where he met Grandma Carolyn and married Grandma Carolyn. And after living in Michigan, then we moved to California. We're jumping on the trampoline. And he said, you wouldn't have met mom if you hadn't moved to California. I said, yeah, you're right about that. And then he dropped it. If your mom hadn't died, I wouldn't be here. Out of the mouth of a 5-year-old. I don't tell this story in order to resolve the mysteries of pain in the universe. I'm just saying, here's this moment where I'm going like, yeah, I'd probably be married to somebody and maybe have some kids, but it wouldn't be Chris and it wouldn't be these kids. I might have ended up in ministry somewhere, but it wouldn't be in the Grand Rapids area that I love and serving the family of Ada Bible Church, which is an incredible privilege. So the life that I now have and the kids that I have and the opportunity I have ended up at the end of a chain of events that were awkward and disruptive, marked by upheaval, where everything changed and everything changed again, but then got us to this place. You say, Jeff, so God let your mom die so you could have these kids. I don't know that. All I can say is that as the angle, getting more toward the wide angle, I just see more. Not through the confused heart of a grieving seventh grader, but at the time, someone pushing through their 40s with distance and healing, able to look back and say, these were some goods that the creative God worked through that tragedy and through that upheaval. If there's one challenge I have today, it is to begin to grow a bedrock trust in the creativity of God. Listen, you might get smacked, body slammed by something that is so hard. All you can cling to is future grace. That God may be powerfully and creatively at work through your pain and through your challenge and through your upheaval. It's even possible to respond with trust and joy through your tears, loss, and suffering out of this bedrock faith that there will come a day when pain will be undone. That's future grace, and it is born from the creativity of God. There's a prayer that I often coach to people who just get body slammed and upended, and it's a simple prayer that kind of goes, okay, God, I don't like this space. I didn't want this space. I don't understand this space. But I will trust you in this space. I think there's just something in the heart of God. It just goes, yes. I don't like this. I didn't ask for this. I don't want this. But I'll trust you. I'll trust you in this space. There are seasons when this can empower you to keep your heart intact, your mind intact, and your faith intact. Because of a trust that God takes that which is a mess and often works that which is unbelievably creatively good. So I want to ask you to stand here at Cascade in our other spaces. And before you race out to your atrium space and conversations and vehicles, some of you just needed that prayer today. So I invite you, if this applies, just to whisper with me. Gracious God, I don't understand this. I don't like this. And I didn't invite this. But help me to trust you here and now. Help me to trust in your creativity. Help me to trust in your future grace. Please, please be fully present with me as you were present with Joseph. And empower me to be present to you and present to others as I journey through this space. We ask this in the name of Jesus, who came and gave his life for us. Amen. We'll see you next week.